So that's been one of our strengths is our DPI. And a lot of it has been, you know, we've probably sold $6 billion last year. A lot of it has been what our play is, don't get our funds too big. Let's do individual asset investing or development. Highly fragmented. 80-85% of what we do is individual investment or development. And then 80-90% of our sales are portfolios, right? So as these funds get larger and they want to get into student housing or they wanted to get into self-storage, they're not going to do $5 and $10 million deals. So not only can we create value at the individual investment level, but then the portfolio creates great portfolio values. And so that's what we just did.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Real Estate Capital. I'm your host, Nancy Lachine of Park Madison Partners. Capital is the lifeblood of the real estate industry, but the decisions on where and how it's allocated are driven by people and personalities. Who are they? What motivates them? What can we learn from their experiences? On this show, we introduce you to some of the real estate industry's most influential thought leaders and decision makers, and we talk about what is important to them, how they make critical decisions, who has influenced them, and a lot more. Our guest on today's episode is Chris Merrill, co-founder and global CEO of Harrison Street Asset Management, one of the world's largest investors in alternative assets. Chris founded Harrison Street in 2005 with seed capital from Michael Galvin of Motorola fame. Today, the firm manages over $109 billion across global real estate, infrastructure, and private credit with over 600 employees stretching from Chicago to Singapore. Chris's career began at Heitman, a Chicago-based real estate manager, as a summer intern at 18 years old. And after only a few years, Heitman allowed Chris to go off to Europe to build out its real estate team there, making him one of the first institutional investors to break ground in the emerging markets of Central and Eastern Europe. After successfully building out Heitman's European business, Chris moved on to his next challenge, building an investment firm focused on alternative real estate assets, which was a fairly contrarian bet at the time. Harrison Street has fundamentally shifted investor perception of alternative real estate, helping move sectors like student housing, senior housing, and medical office from the fringe to the mainstream of institutional portfolios. On this episode, we discuss Chris's motivations to leave an established firm like Heitman to start his own business, the benefits of scale, the importance of experienced local operating partners, and how to build loyalty among your employees. Chris, well, I'm just in awe of you. Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. Harrison Street is, you know, you've gone from like this standing start, you know, of this entrepreneur who started this business, what, 20, 21 years ago?
Yeah, a little bit, just 20 years, I say, but yeah, probably close to 21.
Yeah, to over $100 billion. What's the number now of AUM?
109.
Yeah, well, it's kind of crazy. I'm really hard-pressed to think of someone else in our business who is an entrepreneur who started out as a kid. You know, you had a two handle in front of your age, started in the business and then started a business and you're still running it. And it's so large and global and you've gone into all the things that we're doing that we're all focused on in the real estate space, meaning real assets and high net worth and, you know, global offices and the many things we'll talk about today. So I'm in awe.
Oh, you're too nice. I mean, it's been so lucky, you know, and I've had so many people that have helped along the way. So it's just been a lot of luck, a lot of luck.
A lot of luck. Okay, well, any is that the pearl of wisdom for the day? I think it's a little more than that.
I don't know if it's the pearl of wisdom, but it's definitely, but it certainly helped me. I mean, it's like I said, it's been a lot of fun, a lot of ups and downs, but there are so many people that have just been there for this journey that have helped, whether it's investors, employees, operating partners, et cetera. So,
you know, you've talked a little bit on some other podcasts about your origin story and kind of how you got to Heitman. So I'm going to kind of skip over that because there's so many other things to talk about. And maybe just talk about why did you leave an established platform like Heitman where you had really just a great seat and huge opportunity there to start Harrison Street?
You know, for me, you know, Heitman gave me a start. I was a summer intern for many years there. Had this crazy idea to move to Europe. I was the first employee to move to Europe with this idea of doing the first real estate fund for Central Europe. And it was nice. Heitman gave me the shot to try and do it. You know, I was an investment guy and, you know, I went over and, you know, it was a really interesting thesis, and I won't bore you with the thesis, but, you know, as I started finding investors and opportunities in Central Europe, you know, I was sort of calling back to the States saying, okay, I found a building or I found an opportunity, send the money. And it wasn't that easy. So it sort of forced me to go develop my own capital relationships. Mm-hmm. And sort of, you know, luckily we put together the first fund in Central Europe, did a second fund, and, you know, the thesis really worked out. The cap rates compressed when they joined the European Union and, you know, built a nice team and a business over there. And so I think that kind of put the entrepreneurial bug in me. And it allowed me to sort of build a culture. And I came back to the States and I said, boy, that was fun.
Wait, can we double click on that? When you say build a culture, so you're in Poland primarily?
I was living in London. We had offices in Budapest. We had offices in Warsaw. And, you know, built a team of, let's say, 40 or 50 people. And like I said, Heitman was very supportive. And it was fun because, you know, we were, you know, 3,000 miles away and building a team and a culture. And it was really fun.
How did you know how to build your kid and you're a deal guy? How did you know how to build a culture?
You know, I don't know. I mean, maybe it was common sense. You know, maybe it was, you know, looking at, you know, how I wanted to be treated. But I think for me, you know, what I've really learned, and I think why this Harrison Street experiment has worked, is if you get alignment of interest right, it works. And I think so many people are missing that in this business. And you really need to get alignment of interest right. And so I really enjoyed doing that. And then when I came back to the States, you know, I sort of missed it. I missed, you know, so much of what I did when I went to Europe was, how did you do that? You know, when I was doing Central Europe, people thought, boy, that doesn't make any sense. That's crazy. That's never going to be an institutional market. It was a lot of fun trying to find the new.
And it's very hard
in our business. We're such in so much of a commodity business. It's hard to be different. It's hard to be unique. But I really loved it. And so that was what kind of put the bug in me to try and do it again.
So where did the idea of Harrison Street come from and how'd you get going?
So really, you know, the idea was one of, what could I do to differentiate myself? I really wanted to start a business. Yeah. I wanted to build a business. I wanted to build a culture. But how was I going to go compete in a very competitive business? So I looked at what worked in Central Europe. It was fragmented asset classes. Why Central Europe worked for me was there was big European funds. People would dabble in Central Europe. Maybe they'd put 5 or 10% of their fund in Central Europe. So I said, what if I'm the pure play Central Europe guy? And that's how I started. So I came back to the States and I sort of looked at it and said, where are there similarities? And a lot of people were sort of dabbling in medical office or self-storage or maybe student. But nobody really had a pure play business around demographics. So I said, well, okay, what if I start and become the sort of pure play business around demographic assets, where obviously you're not timing cycles, they're need-based assets, but they're smaller, they're fragmented, you got to roll up your sleeves, you got to find good operating partners, et cetera. And that's where the idea really came from. It could be a way to create something different, unique, innovative that I thought was quite resilient. But the challenge for me was I didn't have capital. And I was probably 34 at the time. When I talk about luck and timing, a gentleman who was a mentor of mine was the former chairman and CEO of Motorola. His family founded Motorola. And he was leaving Motorola, setting up a family office. And I was talking to him, as I had been since I was 12. He was a mentor. I talked to him all the time. And I said, well, I've got this idea around demographic real estate, about being sort of this pure play investor in the space. And he said, boy, that's interesting. And we spent about a year talking about it. And he said, listen, I'd love to partner with you and do that. What do you need? And I said, look, and I've been a first time fund before. I've gone through the consultant colonoscopies. You know, what I need to do is really build a team. I want to start building a track record. And to me, that's the way to be successful. You know, blind funds are tough. And so he really was great, and he gave me the capital to build a team and start making investments.
How much capital did it take in 2005 to build?
You know, it was interesting. Our initial portfolio, we probably had invested $70, $80, $90 million in different products and different strategies, really as a way to sort of prove up the thesis.
And then you syndicate out those deals to investors.
What we did is we used those investments and we contributed my cost in the first fund and had the first closing within sort of 12 months of starting. And that's sort of where the name Harrison Street came from. So we became partners and Motorola started on Harrison Street in Chicago.
So what was fun
for me, you know, obviously his family founded Motorola. Innovation was near and dear to his heart. And so for me, it was always this push on how can we innovate? How can we differentiate what we're doing? Mm-hmm. And so that's really how we got started.
The whole operating partner platforms, which, you know, clearly define the real estate investment business through the 90s and then the 2000s, kind of was key to your getting started. But it's evolved over time to managers building platforms.
Where you
own a piece of the operator who clearly is so key to having the skill set to be successful. How did you start and how have you evolved in that area?
So I think, you know, there's no right model. For me, when I looked at these fragmented sectors, there were certain risks that I didn't want to take. I didn't want our LPs to be exposed to. I didn't want to be exposed to recourse, cost overrun, entitlement. So the idea was, let's go find the best local operators and let's work with them and let's lay off certain risks. Also, the segments we're in, when you're in storage, student, senior, it's hard to find one group that's going to be great nationally. I don't think that really exists in these spaces. As much as people even try today, say, I've got one partner and I can go build across the country. I don't think you can. To me, what we like is I've got a great senior housing partner in the Northwest. I've got a great senior housing partner in Long Island. I've got one in the Northeast. I've got a great student housing partner here. So, to me, I think in these more fragmented asset classes, if you're going to get scale, diversification, if you're going to manage risk, you need to work with these operating partners. Mm-hmm. What we've done over time as we've evolved is we've become more integrated as a business. So I'd say we're almost a vertically integrated manager because we do everything up to property management and leasing. And in some cases, we do some leasing, but we've built a team here that has construction, design, engineering. So we're bringing as much to bear in a lot of cases as the operators, but what I don't want to do is pre-development risk, entitlement risk, cost overrun risk. So, you know, I like to say we're sort of almost in between that operator allocator model, because in a lot of cases, if there's a challenge, we can step in if we need be, we can move operators out if we need be. But what's interesting how we've also evolved is outside of the U.S., we're becoming more vertically integrated, whether it's in Canada or Europe. Mm-hmm. You don't have the depth of operating partner, experience, balance sheets, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So we've had to more create it in other markets.
Right.
But I think that's part of the secret sauce for us is all these people are jumping into the space. We've been doing it for 20 some years. I feel like we've got the best local partners. So a lot of folks that are jumping in are going to make mistakes by, you know, working with groups that are new to the sector. They haven't really dealt with senior housing operations before. They haven't dealt with student housing turn issues. So for us, I think that's been one of the benefits of our platform is just these decades of relationships. We've been very lucky that we've had them.
Are your profit margins similar today as they would have been 15, 20 years ago?
It's a great question. I'd say as we've gotten larger, you know, as you get more scale in this business, I'd say the margins, you know, can get better. But I'd also say things in the business are becoming more expensive. The amount of investment in data is changing. The amount of investment in client service, you know, we want to be closer to the clients. So we have offices in Seoul and Tokyo and the Middle East, getting closer to the clients, right? Client service, you know, there's fee pressure, right? I mean, there's a lot of fee pressure. So I think inherently the margins in the business are getting tougher and tougher. So I'd say on one hand, you need the scale today, but on the same time, you know, the challenges are, you know, people are expensive, data is expensive, fee pressure. It's not an easy business. I mean, it's a very challenging business. And I think that's why you're seeing this monster consolidation.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that, you know, what I like about it is, that's the easy button is just sell out. You know, that's the consolidation, let it happen. For me, I love the fact that we can keep building Harrison Street and my differentiation can be alignment with you, the LP, we're here at Harrison Street. We're not going anywhere. And while the rest of the industry is being consolidated and the firms are getting bigger and bigger, it's leaving this middle market sort of wide open for us.
Yeah. So let's talk about how you found Colliers when you were looking for a capital partner and why they were the right buyer, and then how the firm has grown since then.
Sure. It was interesting. They were more of a partner than a buyer. I mean, what I was looking for in 2018, we were probably 14 or 15 billion of AUM. What I've constantly been looking for.
That's wild. 2005 to 2018, you went from standing start to call it 15 billion in AUM.
Yeah.
2018 to 26, just 8 years later, you've gone to 109 billion.
So there's inorganic in there, and I'll walk you through that. Yeah. So, you know, the first stage was all organic. But for me, it's always been looking, where are the potential defects? Where are the mistakes? Where are the challenges? So I was, you know, I'd say, you know, what was I, probably early 40s, 45 at the time. And one of the challenges is I had a family that owned half the business. Mm-hmm. And that, for me, I was thinking more about what's longevity, right? Mm-hmm. What would happen if something happened to the family? Mm-hmm. How could I start moving more equity to the next generation? I didn't want people to get the same bug I got. Right. And, you know, 12 guys walk in and walk out the door. So I needed to think through an evergreen partner. I needed to think through, how do I move equity to the next generation? Mm-hmm. How do I need to create alignment of interest? So what I was looking for was someone that could come in and help me do that. So I needed someone that would be more of a 60, 70% buyer, because I had to buy the family out and I needed to move equity to the next generation. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted a partner that would let me keep building my culture. I didn't want someone that was going to sit on my management committee, sit on my investment committee. And so, you know, it was a bit of a unicorn I was looking for. Is I was looking for someone who was passive, but would be more of a majority in the business. Mm-hmm. So it was lucky in the sense, again, another lucky situation was Colliers wanted to compete with a JLL, a CBRE. They didn't have an mm-hmm. investment management business. So mm-hmm. they looked at it and said, boy, this would be a nice add to our business, as we want to think about growing our investment management fee stream. So it's controlled by one gentleman, a great guy by the name of Jay Hennick, is the controlling shareholder of Colliers. Had a great meeting with him. And it was tough because the Galvins are, you know, Chris Galvin is like a father to me. And it was not an easy discussion. But the beauty of Chris is he recognized that it was the best for the business. And as much as he did not want to sell his interest, and he'd still love to have it, he recognized it was good for the people and good for our LPs and good for it. So he's just such an amazing man. And he said, look, it's the right thing. Let's go ahead with the transaction. So mm-hmm. brought Colliers in, very much an evergreen partner. Let me move equity. Let me move carry to the next generation. And that allowed us to continue to grow the business. And we, mm-hmm. you know.
Let's talk about the addition of, I know you bought some businesses in Europe and consolidated them. And so you've consolidated your European platform. And then I think you've also brought, in the U.S., you've brought Rockwood under the fold as well. So let's talk about those.
So we'll go through. So what happened was, from 2018 to 2022, Colliers was very pleased with the growth they saw within our business and recognized that they wanted to add other lines of business within investment management. Mm. So Jay, the chairman working with me, went out to identify other businesses. Mm-hmm. So identified Rockwood, traditional real estate, but has a very good debt business. Mm-hmm. Identified a firm called Versus, which mm-hmm. is in the private wealth area. Mm-hmm. A firm called Basalt, which does infrastructure. What was interesting is those businesses were added under Colliers, sort of side by side with me. So we all had our own businesses in partnership with Colliers. And I'd say over the past 2, 3, 4 years, you know, I got to know the folks that ran those businesses very well. Mm-hmm. And we just spent a lot of time talking. And, you know, I looked at it and I said, okay, where's some white space for my firm? Well, I was thinking about, how do we want to get into private wealth? We were thinking about adding debt products to our platform. We have an open-ended infra, again, with FIRST. We created one of the first open-ended infrastructures around public-private partnerships with universities and health systems. And so we were in the infrastructure business. I wanted to add a closed-end side of the infra business. So really sat down with the folks at each of those firms and said, look, we have sort of common ownership. Mm-hmm. Why not put our heads together and make 1 and 1 7? What's the point of us building, you know, six different HR departments, compliance departments, Luxembourg's offices, why not consolidate and give the best service to our clients and give them, you know, better product offerings, et cetera. So we spent the past, you know, 3 or 4 years talking and sort of putting them all together under, you know, frankly, Harrison Street, just because we were the largest. And so we put them under one sort of umbrella, but really let the businesses run as is and let the investment companies run as is, but, you know, put together more of a shared services model, client services model. And to me, what's great is every product is very synergistic and they all help each other.
And do each of those really, businesses have their own IC and their own investment?
Yes and no. Some have now sort of merged in. So we've created it, but what we've tried to do is take the best talent across the ecosystem and use them. So, you know, the infrastructure business had some unbelievable talent. So let's put them on our open-ended infrastructure investment committee. But, you know, their infrastructure closed-end funds, we don't need to change. So what we tried to do is say, okay, where's the best talent? Where can we add the most value? And let's look at that as it relates to different committees for the business. And now we look at it, it's very simple. We're our $110 billion of AUM, North America, Europe, equity, debt, infrastructure, open and closed-end funds. And everything's very synergistic. Everything is sort of mission-critical real estate. Everything has an alternative twist to it. And so it's been great. And now we've got upwards of 1,000 LPs all over the globe.
Wow.
And for me, as investors want fewer relationships, we just want to be someone that's relevant to them that says, hey, look, do you want to keep Harrison Street on the platform, hopefully? And they can offer unique products and, you know, across the capital structure.
You talked about early on alignment of interest as being really key when you went from Central Europe to building your business here. What have you learned about alignment of interest as you've put all these businesses together in terms of motivating people and making sure that you gain as much as you can and don't lose anything in these?
The key is, I mean, it was never a cash out situation. It was a let's all roll together, let's all lock arms, and let's be aligned with our investors on the outcome versus let's all go sell our business and work for another company or have shares in a public business. Right. This was very much, let's get alignment right. Let's all still be meaningful owners of the business. Mm-hmm. Let's move equity to next generation. So to me, the alignment's the big issue that I think a lot of investors and consultants focus on, but you know, I think it's going to be a more and more of a focus as you're seeing the consolidation out there. You're going to see a lot of turnover when firms are sold.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to lose a lot of good folks and it's just going to happen. And so for us, you know, that's where I can differentiate Harrison Street, where I can have a broader ownership structure. I can be more aligned with the investors and the consultants. And, you know, to me, that's what works. When your people are coming to your investment committee and they're approving deals that they have to put their own money in, and it means a lot to them. That's important. You know, your asset managers, your client service folks, everybody's got to have skin in the game. If not, you're going to see turnover. And, you know, as all this consolidation keeps going, I love it. For me, it's a great opportunity to grow, go after great talent. You know, we've added probably 40 or 50 people in the past 12 months. I'm adding great talent to the business because it's really an opportunity to say, okay, this is an entrepreneurial culture. It's a family business. We say family first. We work hard, we have a lot of fun, and we can do it different from a culture standpoint.
And everyone has a specific example, like how you keep someone who wants a more entrepreneurial, like someone comes into you and goes, Chris, I love you. You're a great man, but you know, I got to go do my own thing. And how do you keep someone like that?
I say, what's your own thing? What do you want to do? You want to go work in our London office? Go for it. You want to go, you want to help us grow in Tokyo? Go to our Tokyo office. You want to learn more about data centers? Why don't you work in our data center group? So for me, it's what itch are you trying to scratch and why can't I do it here? Because that's what happened to me is I had the itch I wanted to get scratched. So why can't I incubate that idea here? So tell me what that idea is. If it's, you know, I want to be a school teacher, I can't incubate that. But if there is a, hey, I want to go try this. Well, what is that? You know, we had someone here who did a ton of research. A young gentleman wanted to expand and learn more about renewable energy and solar. And so we kind of moved him into our infrastructure business and he helped us, you know, not only invest in the solar business, but we put solar on the roofs of our storage. So we kind of do a lot of this innovation stuff here. And so I try and, because it's so near and dear to my heart, I try and make sure I'm talking to all of our key people about, let me try and scratch that itch for you here. If I can't, no harm, no foul. You know, I get it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so that,
yeah,
that's the fun thing of the scale is allowing me to do that. And that's
right,
where I,
right,
you know, the important thing I say to the younger folks is it gets bigger and I'm not as close to everyone as I, you know, just tell everyone, you got to advocate for yourself, raise your hand, jump up and down and wave and say, listen, I'm interested in doing something else. Right. I want to do this. I want to do that.
Right.
And that is one of my favorite things about this business. You know, we had 30 interns this year. You know, we have a lot of new, I love that part of this business. I love challenging people. I love, you know, right, I was given a lot of rope at a young age by Heitman, a ton. And so for me, it's a lot of fun to do that same thing.
Yeah, no, that resonates for me for sure. I remember my first job in the investment management business, someone said to me, if there's something you want to do, like just raise your hand and, you know, do it here. And
yeah,
like when I heard that, because I came out of investment banking, I was like, really? And I never left the business after that because, yeah, you know, it just,
it's,
you know,
fun.
It's
and, but
exciting.
You know, that what people recognize is it's then hard to come up with that idea.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Like you've clearly been, you know, a manager who's always been on the edge. You know, you were early into student housing and senior housing and cold storage and all the things that are edge and or what were edge 20 years ago. So what is the new edge for you today?
The thing for us is deepening relationships. So what I think the edge in this business is, what are your relationships? Really, because I think people talk about, I've got this exclusive off-market deal, I did this, and everyone's full of it, right? So where are your relationships? Because that is your edge, the access, yeah, that's creating opportunity. So one of the things that we are really doing is deepening relationships with universities and health systems. Mm-hmm. So we're largest owner of off-campus student housing, largest owner of senior housing, medical properties. Let's go deep with those universities. So we're now the largest probably investor in the public to private sector with universities and health systems. So we work with universities.
Wow.
And we probably have 40 plus relationships with universities where we not only build them housing, we also then have said to these universities, why don't we help you with other real assets, power plant, wastewater treatment, whatever it might be. So what we've done is develop relationships with these groups, and then we bring in a great group to do the housing, or we bring in a great group to do the power plant or district energy. So one of the things that we've tried to do, and it's a very quietly we're doing this because it takes a lot of time, is let's go develop a 50-year relationship with you, and let's do, you know, we're the building, you know, housing at University of Chicago in phase one, phase two, phase three, or IIT will do their power plant. Or so that's been a fun way for us to really deepen our expertise, our relationships. Because now if I'm the biggest owner operator of on-campus housing, well, that's great information if I'm going to do off-campus. Because what I'll see is a lot of people jumping into an off-campus deal and I'll be like, well, that's a mistake. I know that I'm building a ton of on-campus.
Right.
And so it just gives us an informational advantage. So that's been a big expansion. You know, we're doing some really interesting alternative investing in Canada. That's been a great market. We're doing we're building a student housing vertical platform in Europe. We're doing some interesting things in European debt right now. So for us, I think we're trying to take these segments and just keep focusing on need-based asset and just kind of go deeper, whether it's across the capital structure, whether it's geographies, or whether it's the relationships with those partners.
Right. I'm curious how you pick the campuses. I mean, there's a prediction that 15 or 20% of campuses or universities will fail.
For sure.
How do you pick your partners?
For our off-campus business, you know, we've created a proprietary model we call H-Prism. And so we've done, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of investments at universities over the past 20 years. And so what we do is we have a very detailed model that we run everything through. So, you know, the simple thing is we're big Power Four universities. We're not doing small private colleges, you know, very focused on what are the universities that are enrollment takers, where we've seen enrollment growth at the publics. But then within those publics, you've got to really understand the supply fundamentals, the supply dynamics. People are jumping right now into student housing and they're going to get burned because they're going into markets that are going to be oversupplied. They're not in the right location, et cetera. So I think you really have to focus on which schools you think are going to be those enrollment takers. How are they dealing with, you know, you got to look at international students. How are they dealing with AI? How are they doing with virtual learning? How are they dealing with commuter kids? So we kind of go through all those metrics. Mm-hmm. And we do the same thing like in senior housing. We have a model that kind of looks at, you know, income, age, qualifications, It's really, frankly, it's just because we've made mistakes and, you know, it's taking those lessons learned and saying, let's not repeat them. I mean, you know, no one likes to talk about their mistakes. I do. I mean, I try and bring them up a lot of times with investors and say, look, we've made mistakes in these sectors. And I think those scars are making us stronger. I mean, I tell our team, just lean into it. You know, everyone out there talks about how great they are and how every IRR is unbelievable. You know, you got to be honest. You got to be honest in your business and say, look, we've made mistakes, but look at how these mistakes are frankly making us stronger.
And you just sold a very large student housing portfolio.
Yeah.
Is that just in your normal recycling process?
And that actually, that's exactly what our strategy is. So to me, I think DPI is the new IRR, right? Yeah. I think everyone's full of it. When they look at their TVPIs, they say their TVPI is this and their DPI is like nothing. And then you see, as their fundraising cycles get down, you see their TVPI come down as they start realizing.
We should probably explain what TVPI and DPI are for our audience.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, DPI is just the money in your genes. You know, let's return capital. Let's put capital. Let's give capital back to investors, right? That's the challenge right now. And the TVPI is the sort of manufactured internal performance metric where people will say, this is my IRR. My IRR right now is X percent, but you've returned no money. And that's all internal valuations. And as they then raise future funds, you see, as they have realizations, you see that number come down.
Can I quote you on DPI as the money in your genes? Like that. It's a good one.
So that's been one of our strengths is our DPI. And a lot of it has been, you know, we've probably sold $6 billion last year. A lot of it has been what our play is, don't get our funds too big. Let's do individual asset investing or development. Highly fragmented. 80, 85% of what we do is individual investment or development. And then 80 to 90% of our sales are portfolios, right? So as these funds get larger and they want to get into student housing or they wanted to get into self-storage, they're not going to do $5 and $10 million deals. So not only can we create value at the individual investment level, but then the portfolio creates great portfolio values. And so that's what we just did. We just put a bunch of our different operating partners together, put a portfolio of a dozen student housing assets and sold to a larger group. And we've done that a ton of times. Right. And that's, again, if our fund goes from $2 billion to $5 billion to $8 billion to $10 billion, we can't do that. Right. So as funds get bigger and bigger, I love it because we will be the, you know, we'll go do the hard work and we'll sell to you.
So talk about how you're playing in the data center space, because data centers, as we know, are such capital hogs. And I think you were quoted as saying something like you prefer powered shells over wildcatting. How do you play in that space, given you want to keep your fund sizes relatively small?
So it's interesting. So what we do is there's a couple things. Mission critical has been a big theme for us. We started the data center space probably 12 years ago, and it was mission critical. So, you know, we have a couple investments in our infrastructure business around mission critical assets. The carrier hotels, very monopolistic, where everyone comes together in cities. And there's a limited amount of those assets across the country. Very mission critical. So we have a number of those investments in our Evergreen Infrastructure Fund. We also have a dark fiber business, a business that sort of connects the data centers in our infrastructure business. And then in our real estate business, we look at what I would say powered shells. And I almost equate it to a net lease business. We're not in the business of buying land and trying to fight for power for 7 or 8 years. We're not going to go do something in the middle of nowhere that's AI related. It's if there is an opportunity where you've got entitlements, you have access to power, and we've got line of sight to a long-term lease to a hyperscaler, that's an investment we'll make. It's very much a net lease type opportunity. And so that's probably, I'd say that's 10% or so of our business. So it's not a big part of our business because we've got such a tight funnel in terms of how we look at it. But, you know, if we can find these right opportunities, you know, we think it makes sense, but you know, you got to be very careful. And I think there's going to be a lot of people burned with a lot of land that they own that they can't get access to power.
Yeah.
And so it's power is the big thing. And the deals are becoming so big. It's really amazing.
Where's the next wave of growth for Harrison Street?
You know, I think that, you know, we want to keep getting better and better at what we're doing. I think the next wave of growth is really these demographics are global. So we can continue to grow our business in Canada. We can continue to grow in Europe, potentially Asia. But I think for us, it's, you know, when you think about universities, just the tremendous amount of deferred maintenance and the need for capital and the importance of education, the important, you know, as people are living longer, the need for senior housing, assisted memory care. So I just think within healthcare and education, there's just so much opportunity to really deepen those relationships. So I think, you know, we're going to continue to do what we do and continue to look for mission critical investments. And the nice thing is we don't have any pressure on, okay, we've got to get this quarterly growth. We got to get that quarterly growth. We don't really have that pressure. It's really about, you know, this sort of missing middle, this middle market that we can play in. And, you know, really just try and focus on performance and differentiating what we can offer, because we've just got to be relevant. We want to be relevant. We don't want to just say, hey, you know, if you have, you're invested with this manager, that's great. Let me show you how this complements that strategy. We're not trying to replace other managers. We're trying to complement other managers.
Right. In the high net worth channel, I believe you launched the first ETF.
Oh yeah, we have an infrastructure ETF. Yeah, it's, you know, so we have a private wealth business that has a series of interval funds, and you know, we launched an interesting ETF in the infrastructure space. It was new, it was unique. There's a big interest, obviously, from the retail channel to get exposure to infrastructure is not easy, and so that's been a nice product to add. And now, what's fun about having the private wealth business? Again, it's a very small. It's probably 3 or 4% of our business right now. Mm-hmm. Is we're really working with, how can we create really unique creative products to sort of target that retail community, that high net worth market, the RIAs, et cetera. And so what's nice is that market really understands education. They get healthcare. And so it's a nice story to tell, you know, the high net worth investor, you know, who everyone's dealing with a loved one that's got health or memory issues. People are dealing with their kids going to school. So it really resonates on that sort of platform. So that's going to be a big area of growth for us over time. You know, right now it's a small part of our business. And
The ETF invests in public or private securities?
It's in public infrastructure investments. Okay. And then we have an infrastructure fund that will invest in private funds and direct deals.
Right. Well, I mean, being able to start launching in that high net worth channel will be an important growth engine for the business.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. You know, we'll see what it does. You know, it's, again, like I said, there's no overly pressure on it. It's, you know, for us, how can we expand relationships with groups and offer access to products and, structures that work for those. And that's what's fun about it.
Yeah. How do you organize, now that you really are so global and have 600 people plus, how do you organize sort of for culture and for alignment of the team?
Yeah, I mean, we have a great leadership team. I mean, each one of the businesses that came together has great leaders themselves. You know, everyone's aligned in the culture and vision. And I think it's a lot of coming together. We try and communicate a lot. You got to communicate a ton. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a lot of communication on what we're doing, why we're doing it. I think it's really encouraging all the teams to get together all over the world and really, you know, spend time as a firm together. And then I think, again, it's creating that alignment, you know, creating mm-hmm. financial alignments, creating growth opportunities. But, you know, to me, at the end of the day, it's communication. It's transparency. You know, what are you doing? Why? You know, you don't want to be a firm that the employees hear something, you know, they see the news is on Bloomberg and then they find out, oh my gosh, the company's been sold or did something. And so I think, you know, for me, you really have to communicate a lot. And I think, you know, we do a lot of town halls and, you know, sometimes we probably over communicate in some cases, but I think that's the way you got to do it.
Do you share investment strategies across the different parts of the business?
Mean, for sure. I mean, that's the beauty of it is, you know, frankly, we're not going to do a strategy unless it helps the other strategies. That's been the governor on what we do. If the new strategy doesn't in some way help the platform, we won't do it. So that's kind of a governor itself. But if, okay, we've got an infrastructure fund, so now I can say to the university president, hey, we'll put your real estate here and we'll put this in the infrastructure fund, or, you know, I can say to an operating partner, I have a debt fund that can provide you debt financing now. Mm-hmm. You know, so to me, it's, again, creates us very sticky to all of these, you know, relationships, if you like.
Right.
And so that's always the governor. I say, how does that new product tell me where the synergies are now and how is that helping? Where's the informational advantage and where are the opportunity that's creating, whether it's access or informational advantage?
You're still a really young guy, but do you ever think about you are. Do you ever think about legacy? What's important to you?
I do. It's interesting. The first time I started thinking about it, you know, one of my sons is really interested in the business. And it was this summer, he had a great internship. He's a young man, Charlie. He is going to be a junior in college. And he had a great internship in real estate, not with me, with another firm, and really learned about, you know, investing in development and cap rates, and spent a lot of time with me this summer. Kind of, it was a lot of fun talking about the business. And
yeah.
It's the first time I started thinking, man, this is fun. You know, this is fun. And I do, in the sense of there's so many people here that what I don't want to do, I don't want this culture to end. And so I don't want it to be, okay, I get to a certain age and we sell the business and now everyone's working for an insurance company or something. I don't want that. I do want this to be something that can continue to grow. I want people to be rewarded. You'd love to find a way to continue to innovate in the space. It's very hard. And, you know, in the real asset space, to innovate is really hard. So trying to push that. So, you know, to me, I would love this thing to keep going because it has been so rewarding for me, and in a way where the rewarding part of the business is, you think of what you do every day, right? You're investing for people's, in a lot of cases, people's pension funds, but how you're doing it, right? You know, watching what we were able to do during COVID, how we took care of people at the senior housing properties was really rewarding. You know, I get notes from parents on, they're so happy with how their kid is doing it, their student is doing it at the universities, and the safe, well, you know, kept housing. And so it's kind of fun. And so I use those letters and stuff and I share them with the firm. So it's a kind of a rewarding business. You're doing this mission critical investing.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
You know, Chris, I started out by saying how impressed I am with you, but like, wow, having watched probably hundreds of people try to launch businesses like this, you've managed to figure out how to do it in a truly entrepreneurial way and build something that's truly of scale and differentiated. So you did that and you're still going at it. So it's really fun to watch all the things you're doing. And I think your movement into energy and digital has a lot more legs to it that we probably haven't even started seeing yet. And I'm curious to see what you'll end up doing in Asia. I know you've made some hires there and, you know, that's a whole new something. So,
I would say, Nancy, my partners have been, they're all a lot smarter than me and they're just great people. And, you know, we've had such a great team of folks that have been together. And then the other thing is the investors and the consultants have supported us since the beginning and they've continued to support us. And how do you thank them for that? And so for me, it's like, the thanking is waking up every day and just saying, hey, we got to deliver. And we've just had so many people that have helped and supported this thing that it's been amazing.
Yeah. Any words of advice for those college age kids who might be listening?
You know, the one thing I do always say, not, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but I always tell the college folks, when I sit down with our interns or our analysts, is just be patient. If you want to be in this industry, your value is on having done things and repetition. And I think, you know, for me, it's if you find yourself with a good organization, you have good mentorship and you're being challenged, just stick it out. And your value is that repetition. And so I always say, you know, frankly, this is an industry, you just got to be patient. And, you know, it will come. Make sure you're at an organization where you have good mentorship and you're learning and you're being pushed. You know, raise your hand and ask for more. But if you are, then don't worry about what your title is and jumping firms so you can have a bigger title and just be patient. You know, for me, that worked. And I think that's what this industry is. It's repetition. It's doing things and seeing things. And that's where your value is really, really comes out.
Amazing advice. I can't thank you enough, Chris, for doing this. Appreciate it.
You're so nice, Nancy, to have me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Real Estate Capital. Before you go, I have a quick favor to ask. We put a lot of thought and effort into this show and making sure we bring you insights from real estate leaders that you don't normally find in the mainstream media. So if you're enjoying this show, please remember to follow it on your favorite podcasting app so you never miss an episode. We'd also love for you to share it with others or give us a review on Apple Podcasts so others can find us. Thanks again for tuning in. For more information about our firm, please visit our website at parkmadisonpartners.com.